KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
What you find is a population that is eating one and a half meal per day maximum.
In Gaza, nearly 500,000 people are facing starvation as a complete blockade of humanitarian supplies into the territory continues.
For Tuesday, May 13th, this is All Things Considered.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ilse Chang. South Carolina is one of the most restrictive states for abortion access.
Some who call themselves abortion abolitionists say the state's laws don't go far enough.
If they can make people think in their town that it's illegal to leave the state for an abortion, then they've done their job.
Also, a House committee has proposed a huge federal funding increase for the Kennedy Center.
President Trump took it over in February, and the White House has made sweeping cuts to the arts.
I just think that it would be wise and prudent to have a little bit of congressional oversight.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. In a lavish welcome from his Saudi host, President Donald Trump has kicked off his Mideast visit. Trump announcing what the White House says is $600 billion in commitments from Saudi Arabia to U.S. companies. NPR's Franco Ordonez is traveling with the president and has more on the start of the president's visit.
They really rolled out the red carpet for Trump, or in Saudi's case, a lavender carpet. You know, Trump was escorted to the Saudi airport by a group of F-15 fighter jets, and the whole day was incredibly lavish with two Arabian horse welcomes, there were camels and multiple receptions. We just got back from a big state dinner where there were traditional drummers.
The Saudis had a far frostier relationship with former President Joe Biden. Trump, meanwhile, said he will lift U.S. sanctions on Syria and said he'll meet with the country's new president, Ahmed al-Shara, on Wednesday. Headaches continue at Newark Liberty International Airport in New Jersey. It's been plagued by technical problems and ongoing construction. As NPR's Joe Hernandez reports, the radar facility that serves the airport only had 3 traffic controllers per hour scheduled Monday night.
The FAA confirmed that at least 3 controllers were scheduled each hour at the Philadelphia radar facility that directs traffic in Newark's airspace. The New York Times said an agreement between the FAA and the Air Traffic Controllers Union dictates that 14 controllers should have been working during most of that time. Neither the FAA nor the union responded to questions about that agreement. Delays and cancellations have plagued Newark's airport in recent weeks due to staffing shortages, technical problems, and runway construction. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy announced a plan last week to overhaul the National Air Traffic Control System, which some estimates say could cost billions. Joe Hernandez, NPR News.
Newly elected Pope Leo XIV has spoken with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, according to the Vatican's press office. NPR's Jason DeRose reports from Rome. The Pope began speaking about Ukraine over the weekend.
President Zelensky posted on social media following a phone conversation with the Pope that he was thankful for his support of Ukraine. During remarks from the balcony overlooking St. Peter's Square Sunday, Pope Leo called for a true, just, and lasting peace in the war-torn nation. He also called for the children that had been deported from Ukraine to Russia to be returned to their families. Zelensky's social media post also said that his country counts on the Vatican's assistance in bringing them home. And the Ukrainian president wrote that he invited the Pope to make an official visit to his country to bring hope to the people there. Jason DeRose, NPR News, Rome.
Inflation ticked up slightly last month. The government's broadest measure of inflation, the consumer price index, rose 0.2%. On Wall Street, a mixed close. The Dow was down 269 points today. You're listening to NPR. Federal safety regulators are requesting more information from electric vehicle maker Tesla about how its driverless taxis will avoid causing accidents when they take to the streets of Austin, Texas next month. National Highway Traffic Safety Administration asking for specifics like how the taxis, which lack steering wheels, will operate safely in low visibility conditions like fog. The agency is already investigating accidents involving the vehicles in similar conditions, one of which was fatal. Tesla CEO Elon Musk has assured investors the launch next month and a national rollout will not be delayed. The player holding the record for the most career hits, Pete Rose, is now eligible for admittance into Major League Baseball's Hall of Fame. From Cincinnati, where Rose spent much of his career, WVXU's Bill Reinhardt has more.
Pete Rose was banned from the MLB in 1989 after he was shown to have lied about gambling on the game. He was placed on a permanent ineligibility list as punishment. Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred says that list was meant to protect the integrity of the game. Rose died in September, and Manfred says the Hit King is no longer a threat. The chair of the Hall of Fame, Jane Forbes Clark, says now that Rose is no longer on the ineligible list, sports writers will be able to put him on the ballot. Wednesday would have been Rose's 84th birthday. For NPR News, I'm Bill Reinhart in Cincinnati.
For the first time since last fall, sides egg prices, an ongoing thorn in the side of the Trump administration, are coming down. Trump had promised to do something about high egg prices, which reached a record price of $6.23 a dozen in March. Egg prices have fallen to below that, down about a dollar a dozen last month. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. Nearly 500,000 people in Gaza are now facing starvation. That is according to a new report from the IPC, International Panel of Famine Experts, who advise the United Nations. The UN says hundreds of truckloads of life-saving supplies are waiting to enter Gaza, but for more than 10 weeks, Israel has enforced a complete blockade of humanitarian supplies into the territory, accusing Hamas of stealing aid. To talk more about this, let's bring in Antoine Renard. He is the representative and country director of the United Nations World Food Program in the Palestinian territories, and he joins us now from Jerusalem. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Antoine, even when aid was able to get into Gaza, food was quite scarce, and now, more than 2 months into this blockade, how would you describe the situation there?
It's actually difficult to find proper words to describe what is happening. After the ceasefire in mid-January, we were really, as humanitarian, for the first time practically since the beginning of the war, managing to reach the population at scale. Since the 2nd of March, with a full closure now for more than 70 days, what you find is a population that is eating one and a half meal per day maximum. The prices on the market, I'm just coming back from Gaza. I came back on the 11th of May. Wheat flour, a bag of 25 kg is actually now $560.
And we'll just note here for listeners, we're talking about 25 kilograms. That's somewhere around 55 pounds of flour.
So the challenge that you have is that most of the population are not able to afford such a cost. And the challenge that you have as well is the quality of the wheat flour that is left. It's in very bad condition. People are smashing macaroni to do bread so long that the kids can actually still see bread on the table, if there is a table.
The WFP has said it ran out of food to support its hot meal kitchens in Gaza a few weeks ago. All of your bakeries closed a month before that. What is it like to have to shut down your organization's support network in Gaza at a time where there's just so much need?
The challenge that you have is that you actually wonder when the countdown will finish, because we used to serve 1 million meals per day until the end of April with all the different actors on the ground, not just the World Food Program. Then it started to be 500,000 a week ago, and now we are 250,000 meals per day. When are we going to stop this countdown? And we have all the food in the different corridors in Egypt, in Ashdod, in Jordan. For your radio listener, it's food is not even 40 kilometers from where people are.
If I heard you correctly, you said you've drawn down from serving 1 million meals a day between the World Food Program and partners to now just 250,000 a day, is that correct?
It's correct. And even, you know, the type of meal that they have on the table, if it's called a lentil soup, one of the family I was meeting last Sunday was telling me that they are actually, with their kids, counting the lentils so like that, they actually remember that it is a lentil soup. They were counting 16 lentils into the soup, and that's your main meal for the day.
Israel has said that it is blocking aid from entering Gaza in order to force Hamas to come to the negotiating table. I'd like to ask you, do you consider this blockade a violation of international humanitarian law?
You know, the current period, we're feeling like we were in December 2024, early January. We were really contemplating that it was the end of the road for us as humanitarian to operate, and we managed to have the ceasefire. So we need to have the mediators for what is the current situation.
If this blockade were to be completely lifted right now, would that be enough to undo the damage that has already been done there in Gaza in terms of malnutrition?
The impact is and will actually last for a long time. You've got a number of children that are actually growing. They are -5. They need to have a proper and adequate dietary diversity. They don't have meat, they don't have dairy products, they don't have fish. There's no fruit anymore into Gaza. There's barely still some vegetables where you have cucumber, tomatoes, aubergine that are locally produced, but at such a low level and at such a cost, it will clearly have a long-term impact related to those that have been now 19 months into this conflict.
As you were saying, you've just returned from Gaza several days ago, so you've been able to see firsthand what many of our listeners have not. What do you think it's important for them to know and to understand about the situation there, the hunger that is being experienced?
I mean, I've been going to Gaza in really different periods. I've been, you know, just before the ceasefire, and I remember how the weight that was on the shoulder of the civilian population was lifted with the fact that the ceasefire was coming. I look now at the families that I've met, the despair that was there. And I think that the most important for us is to remind that the population there have a human face. They are actually are part of our humanity, and they deserve actually also to ensure that they have a future. And that's why, you know, even if it looks very dire and bleak now, this is why we need to continue to advocate to give them also a sense of humanity.
We have been speaking with Antoine Renard of the World Food Program. Thank you so much.
Thanks to you.
The Israeli agency that coordinates humanitarian aid rejected the findings of the IPC report on the social media platform X, saying, quote, "The IPC's projections have consistently failed to predict the reality on the ground."
Last week, Bill Gates announced that his foundation would accelerate its charitable giving, spending more than $200 billion over the next 20 years and drawing down his personal fortune before wrapping up its mission. Now, most philanthropies don't have that kind of money, but in the wake of the recent U.S. withdrawal from many of its foreign aid commitments, some of these charities are wondering, what can we do? NPR's Ari Daniel has this story about a small team with a plan.
When I look around Caitlin Tulloch's home in Oakland, California, it's clear the world outside the U.S. has made an impression on her.
This is a really lovely piece of embroidery that I bought in a town called Mehong Son in Thailand.
And there's textiles from Kenya, Uzbekistan, Guatemala, and on her office door,
a little gold sign that says Caitlin Tulloch, Grand Poobah of Cost Effectiveness.
And cost-effectiveness is really important to Tulloch as an economist. For over a decade, she's used data to make sure every dollar spent on humanitarian aid programs really makes a difference. That's what she'd been doing at the United States Agency for International Development when the Trump administration began dismantling it.
Just wiped off the map.
Eventually, Tulloch started wondering
what I can do with my skill set to take care of people, improve human welfare.
And then she got a call.
I remember I was sitting at the table right there.
It was a foundation she knew. And then another call from another foundation. And they were both asking the same question. With the U.S. having cut thousands of foreign aid programs, could they step in and help?
People are saying, if I have $2 million, if I have $5 million, what should I pick up?
So she and several colleagues went to foreignassistance.gov and downloaded a spreadsheet listing all the foreign aid programs once funded by USAID, some $35 billion worth.
And it's lovely because they're tagged by country and by sector and by purpose.
Can you show me your spreadsheet?
That's my favorite question.
Telic scrolls through the document.
So we didn't even pull in the full database. I think we pulled in about 10,000 rows.
Oh my goodness. You've got Malawi tuberculosis control, Nepal STD control.
It's like a heat map of what was being done where.
Telic and her small team then had to figure out what to prioritize.
It's really a terrible set of decisions.
They painstakingly calculated which programs were the most cost-effective and life-saving. They've managed to whittle it down so far to 54, amounting to $96.5 million of need, projects they call urgent and vetted. Telic knows it's nowhere near enough to fill the hole in funding that U.S. cuts left behind.
This is not about getting everything we want, making things whole again.
But it's something. Telic surveyed her list. One project leapt to the front of the line.
It's a project in Mali that was delivering treatment for acute malnutrition for children mostly under five.
And in the middle of a civil war. But earlier this year, Telic says the U.S. government suspended the program before bringing it back, but only through July.
It is inherently a very volatile environment in which to be making decisions.
Telic's team determined that with a relatively small investment, the program could be sustained, and the distribution of life-saving nutritional support to thousands of women and children could continue, independent of U.S. funding decisions. So they connected with a Boston-based foundation called CRI, which funds health projects in Africa, explained the situation, and said they should act. Now. The foundation was relieved to hear about the opportunity. Kara Weiss is the group's executive director.
To have someone come to you and say, well, we're just going to go through the entire portfolio and get some answers. Like, yes, please.
They wound up contributing $2.5 million to the Mali program, about half what it used to get from the U.S. government.
Private philanthropy is not going to be able to fill all the gaps, but what we can do is keep projects functioning so that it's possible for local organizations or local governments to take them over.
In the meantime, the group in Mali, the Alliance for International Medical Action, was thrilled when they got the news. Geoffrey Kakezi Mambweni runs the group.
When I was able to inform our teams out in the field that we had finally secured financing, it was just so much joy.
For Caitlin Tulloch, it brings her a little closer to her goal.
Fewer children dying who didn't need to die.
Tulloch's group calls itself Project Resource Optimization. They've now made 13 matches, and their singular focus is getting more programs on that urgent and vetted list funded. And fast. Ari Daniel, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. South Carolina is one of the most restrictive states when it comes to abortion access. Abortions are only allowed up to 6 weeks into a pregnancy, but some on the far end of the anti-abortion movement say that that is not restrictive enough. NPR domestic extremism correspondent Odette Youssef recently spent some time with some of these activists in Greenville. She joins us now. Hi, Odette.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, so tell us more about these people you met with.
Well, they call themselves abortion abolitionists, and they were gathering in Greenville for a regional conference in March. It was convened by a group called Operation Save America. They're a rebrand of Operation Rescue, which you may recall from the 80s and 90s staged huge blockades of women's health clinics.
Right.
The Southern Poverty Law Center calls Operation Save America a hate group, but OSA leaders say they're just committed to saving the, quote, pre-born. This is really the farthest edge of the anti-abortion rights movement.
And I understand you met some of these members outside a women's health clinic. Is that right?
Yes. On a Thursday morning, dozens of activists were posted outside a clinic in Greenville. That's one of the last three clinics that offer abortions in South Carolina.
My friends, today's the day that you got to start using your head that God gave you.
And they were trying to intercept people who were headed into the clinic.
Ma'am, if this loser has brought you here to kill his child, what kind of man is he?
Many activists brought their families. Small kids played in the grass by a busy road. Teenage girls hold up signs with graphic images of bloody fetuses or messages like, date rapists love abortion. It's a school day, but parents here say this is part of their children's Christian education. Among these activists is a man named Jason Storms.
The next generation, we've been raising up and training up to be a strong voice here for justice and for children and families.
Storms is national director of Operation Save America. He's bothered by the fact that even after Roe was overturned, this clinic remains open. And he blames that on most of South Carolina's Republican lawmakers.
A lot of these guys are fake pro-lifers. They're pro-life frauds, right?
There's another thing that bothers Storms, and it's that after Roe fell, estimates of abortion in the U.S. went up. He believes the reason is that women are able to self-administer abortions at home with pills. He proposes a solution to this, as he calls it, loophole. Punish women who get abortions. It isn't a new idea, but historically, it's one that the Republican Party has not endorsed. And now it seems to be gaining ground. Bills were introduced in at least 14 states during the current or most recent sessions, a record. And in South Carolina, Storms and activists were busy making the rounds.
We did a lit drop in the district of the Speaker of the House and put some pressure, you know, via staff and so forth. But we focused more on the Senate.
Abortion rights advocates don't expect these bills to pass, but they're still paying close attention. Jessica Valenti is author of Abortion, Our Bodies, Their Lies, and the Truths We Use to Win.
Whereas Republican legislators used to talk about these bills as these are outliers, these are extremists, they have nothing to do with, you know, the Republican Party. Now they're sort of saying, well, it's good to hear everyone out, right? Like they're saying that they want them to be a part of the conversation.
Elements of extremism are baked into this militant anti-abortion movement with justifications for anti-government activity and even violence. But first, it's worth noting that these bills could affect many more than just pregnant women. All the bills defined fertilized eggs as full humans, with the exception of Oklahoma's, where prior abortion law had already established that. They still allow for abortion to save a mother's life, but otherwise, these bills consider abortion to be homicide. This could mean certain forms of birth control would also become illegal, and it could jeopardize access to popular IVF services. Again, Valenti.
Abortion rights are very, very much about a small group of extremist legislators imposing their will on the vast majority of Americans who do not want these laws.
In 2023, legislators in South Carolina were presented with a similar bill. It would have punished women who get elective abortions. But after a national publication wrote about it, almost half the bill's sponsors withdrew their names. NPR reached out to 17 members of the state's House Republican Caucus leadership to talk about the bill currently filed there. Few responded. Those who did declined interviews. Even if these bills fail, though, activists still believe they have a fail-safe.
Well, thank y'all for being here again. I'm gonna read from Psalm 72. Then
the morning after I met them outside the clinic, Operation Save America held a pastor's brunch in a small storefront church. Roughly 20 listened to OSA leaders explain how to pressure state legislators. One of them raised his hand. He said that his reality felt far away from the business of state politics.
I'm a pastor in a small town. So what are some, and is there differences? Is there a different approach to, say, a small town mayor than there is a representative at the state capitol?
Jason Storms responds to the question with a book title.
There's a good book I recommend called The Doctrine of the Lesser Magistrates.
The Doctrine of the Lesser Magistrates. It was first published more than a decade ago. It's rooted in a goal of bringing a certain kind of Old Testament biblical governance to America, one that would criminalize abortion, same-sex relations, no-fault divorce, and adultery. It argues that local officials have a Christian duty to defy state and federal laws that they deem immoral. The author of the book is a pastor who once co-signed a statement calling the 1993 murder of a women's doctor outside a clinic justifiable. He's also Storm's father-in-law. Jessica Valenti says promoting the belief that mayors, sheriffs, or council members are the law when it comes to abortion can change how people behave.
If they can institute a chilling effect in their communities, if they can make people think in their town that it's illegal to leave the state for an abortion, then they've done their job. They don't need it to be written in the law.
Yes, interesting. I mean, the thing is, Odette, polling does show that most Americans still believe that there should be some right to access abortion. So how is this part of the anti-abortion movement making inroads in South Carolina?
Well, something that stood out to me in Greenville, Elsa, meeting leaders within this movement is that they're all men, every single one. Hmm. And their messaging around abortion is completely wound up with messaging about what it is to be a man. And so we're also reporting on how this movement is building off a heightened national discussion right now about manhood. And in this corner of it, the call for biblical manhood. I'll be back tomorrow with more on that.
That is NPR's Odette Youssef. Thank you so much, Odette.
Thank you.
And this story was made possible in part by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting.
This is NPR News.
Since taking over the Department of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has fired thousands of workers and canceled billions in grants. Now Congress is getting a say in those changes.
There has always been bipartisan support for HHS programs. That's how they survived.
That story on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Coming up, there's some good news about inflation. Shoppers got a break last month at the grocery store, including plunging egg prices.
We're brunch, so there's not as much freedom to lean into other things. When 70% of your menu makes up eggs, you got to get creative.
Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Businesses in the U.S. may now take advantage of the 90-day pause in tariffs announced by the U.S. and China this week. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports the temporary suspension affects billions of dollars worth of goods and products.
Some companies are moving to expedite shipments and lock in contracts before the narrow window closes. Mark Wu, an international trade expert at Harvard University, says the short-term reprieve may temporarily stabilize or even lower prices.
One area where there will be cheaper goods is in the online e-commerce space. So as part of the agreement, the tariffs on the online direct shipments from China are going to decline, and those would have taken effect soon.
Experts say the pause in tariffs is also creating a frenzy of uncertainty as businesses try to predict what happens next. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
In Texas, the state health department there has added three more counties to its measles outbreak. From Texas Public Radio, Bonnie Petrie tells us two of those counties are in Dallas.
The three new counties, including two just north of Dallas, reported only one case each of measles linked to the West Texas outbreak. But University of Texas Health Science Center, San Antonio, Dr. Jason Bowling says even one infectious person in a new area is a concern.
Because each time you see a new case, you worry that they might go into a pocket where there's some group of unvaccinated people. And because it's so transmissible, might see continued bump in the numbers.
The state health department also added 8 new cases to the outbreak total since Friday's update, bringing the case count to 717 and noted one additional hospitalization. 93 people have been hospitalized with measles in Texas since.
You're listening to NPR. The Indian military says its forces have killed 3 people accused of being terrorists amid a ceasefire in some of the worst fighting in decades between India and Pakistan. NPR's Dia Hadid reports.
The spokesman declined to be identified in line with military guidelines. The Himalayan territory of Kashmir is divided between India and Pakistan and claimed by both. India often accuses militants operating in the territory as being sent by Pakistan, including an attack by gunmen who killed 26 people in late April. Pakistan denies any connection, but last Wednesday, India struck the country, setting off clashes that ended Saturday with a ceasefire. Also Tuesday, airlines announced they were cancelling flights in border areas after residents reported drones above their cities. It wasn't immediately clear if that represented a violation of the ceasefire. Dia Hadid, NPR News, Mumbai.
In Paris, French actor Gérard Depardieu has been convicted of sexually assaulting 2 women on a film set in 2021. The 76-year-old was given an 18-month suspended sentence today and fined more than $32,000. Depardieu has been one of France's most prominent actors for decades. He was convicted of groping a woman responsible for decorating the film set. Another was a female assistant. His name now registered in France's National Sex Offender Database. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. Shoppers found some savings at the grocery store and the gas station last month. That helped keep overall inflation in check. So far, the trade war has not had much impact on the overall cost of living, but economists warn that could change in the months to come. NPR's Scott Horsley joins us for more. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Juana.
So, Scott, these details, they all come from today's inflation report, which was a little bit better than forecasters had expected. What's it telling us?
It tells us the overall cost of living last month was up just 2.3% from a year ago, and 2.3% is the smallest annual increase in more than 4 years. Prices rose only a little bit between March and April, and some prices even went down during the month. Gasoline prices were down, as you mentioned, and egg prices, which have been such a sore spot for many people, fell by double digits. That's a big relief for omelet lovers and bakers and for Ed Powers, who buys eggs for a chain of 41 restaurants called the Broken Yolk Cafe.
We're brunch, so there's not as much freedom to lean into other things. When 70% of your menu makes up eggs, you got to get creative.
Power sometimes struggled over the last 6 months to find enough eggs as avian flu wiped out millions of egg-laying chickens. But egg farmers are cautiously optimistic that a recovery is now underway, and Power says his prices have started coming down.
The growth of the hens are starting to catch up. It's a positive trend right now. We see it getting better.
Egg prices at the supermarket fell nearly 13% in April. They are still up almost 50% from a year ago, though, so there's still a ways to go before egg prices are back to normal.
All right, glad to hear that. A little bit of relief for my household's grocery bill, at least. And we also have heard, Scott, that inflation is cooling off, but I know that's not the story across the board. So tell us what's getting more expensive.
Right. Housing costs are still going up. Electricity's more expensive. So is car insurance. Furniture prices jumped about 1.5% last month, and that could be an early warning sign of what's to come as higher tariffs start showing up in retail prices. We didn't see a whole lot of that in the April numbers, but forecasters do think tariffs will start to push up the price of other imports in the months to come, especially for things like new cars and clothing.
Okay, and what about the deal that the U.S. made with China over the weekend to temporarily lower tariffs? Is that going to help?
Maybe. Over the weekend, officials in the U.S. and China agreed to dial back those triple-digit tariffs that had brought much of the trade between the two countries to a standstill. For at least 90 days, the tax on imports from China will be 30% rather than 145%. But economist Ernie Tedeschi, who's with the Yale Budget Lab, says even with that tariff reduction, the U.S. is still charging a higher tax on imports now than at almost any time in the last century, you know, since the protectionist push by Senator Smoot and Congressman Hawley back in the 1930s.
So we're back to Smoot-Hawley days, which, remember, Smoot-Hawley is now widely blamed by economic historians as accelerating the Great Depression.
Tedeschi and his colleagues warn that today's tariffs are still high enough to cause both higher inflation and slower economic growth, and that could be a challenge for the Federal Reserve.
Well, how is the central bank likely to respond to this data?
Right now, markets are betting the Fed will keep interest rates relatively high when policymakers meet next month. You know, the Fed tends to focus on core inflation, which excludes energy and food prices, which bounce around a lot. Core inflation is still a little higher and stickier, so the Fed's likely to take its time in cutting interest rates. In any case, we will get another inflation report before the central bank has to make that decision in June.
NPR Scott Horsley, thank you.
You're welcome.
The Trump administration has launched a massive project to create one of the holy grails of modern medicine, a universal flu vaccine. But the ambitious initiative is perplexing many vaccine experts. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein reports.
The project, dubbed Generation Gold Standard, is aimed at finally creating a flu shot that doesn't have to be updated every year.
Right now, we have to go in and every year make a vaccine for every flu season.
Ted Ross is the director of global vaccine development at the Cleveland Clinic.
We want to be able to use the same vaccines year after year in order to neutralize viruses as the viruses change over time. If you could have a vaccine that can elicit an immune response for many years, is a more effective vaccine than what we're doing today.
But the new administration surprised the vaccine world earlier this month with a big new push to produce a universal flu vaccine, a project that the administration says could also lead to a vaccine that could protect against other viruses that could cause the next pandemic, like bird flu and coronaviruses. The announcement was unexpected because of the anti-vaccine stances of top Trump administration health officials like Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
I'm glad to see that this administration is still wanting to invest in developing next generation or better influenza vaccines and respiratory vaccines in general.
But Ross and other outside vaccine experts are puzzled by many aspects of Generation Gold Standard. First of all, the project will use one strategy, injecting people with a whole virus that has been killed to render it harmless but still capable of stimulating the immune system.
This is a head scratcher to me. This is puzzling.
Dr. Gregory Poland is at the Atria Academy of Science and Medicine in New York City.
We're going back to technology that was used 40, 50 years ago or more. So this is a little surprising to me why you would go backwards to this technology. It's a very old technology. I mean, this is what influenza vaccines in the 40s, 50s, and 60s looked like.
Whole-killed virus vaccines tend to trigger more side effects, like high fevers and seizures that scare parents. And newer technologies are showing more promise with fewer side effects.
We have live attenuated nasal spray influenza vaccines. We have recombinant influenza vaccines. We have an mRNA-based influenza vaccine. So why would you put all of your eggs in one basket?
And then there's the price tag, $500 million, according to the administration. That's a huge amount, especially at a time when the Trump administration is slashing funding for medical research. Rick Bright is a former federal vaccine expert.
This amount of money is astronomical. It is foolish to put that much money onto one technology. What we need now is bold 21st century solutions, not a retreat into nostalgia.
Another aspect that's raising eyebrows is that the whole-killed virus platform was developed by two NIH scientists who have aligned themselves with the new administration. One holds a patent related to the technology, and it was picked without independent public review and based on only very limited preliminary testing, outside experts say. Dr. Jesse Goodman is at Georgetown University.
So that's odd. If you're going to do this, have an open scientific competition for the best ideas. There should be transparency about the process for deciding how to allot funding.
In announcing the project, officials said Generation Gold Standard, quote, represents a decisive shift towards transparency, efficiency, and comprehensive preparedness, unquote. The administration says a universal vaccine should be ready for wide-scale testing next year and could be available to the public within 4 years, which is a very optimistic timeline to accomplish something so ambitious. Rob Stein, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. Today's story comes from a listener who asked that we refer to him by his first initial A to protect his identity around a mental health issue. A few years ago, A's life took a strange turn. He started having a hard time sleeping and began experiencing delusions. He believed that he was a sleeper agent for the U.S. government and had just been awakened to begin his mission.
It was a fascinating reality. I dove in headfirst and began to believe that the government had a base on the far side of the moon and I was destined to be picked up by a helicopter, taken to a spaceship, and flown to that base. Needless to say, I was experiencing a psychotic episode. I went to work and told my boss that I needed to quit my job because I was needed for national security purposes. My boss took it in stride, as best she could. She sat down in her chair and slumped back, clearly hit by the weight of what I had said. I then went on to do things that I would rather not disclose and wound up in jail for a DUI, which was really driving under the influence of a psychotic episode. As I was sitting in jail, the staff told me that I would be released soon and that someone would be coming to talk to me. That person was a designated crisis responder who had received a call from my boss explaining that I was in some sort of psychotic state and needed help. She came to visit me at jail, got me out, and got me psychiatric treatment. My unsung hero is my boss. If she had not noticed the signs for what they were, and without judgment, called on the crisis responders, I can honestly say I would probably be dead or incarcerated for committing some crime that as part of my delusion I thought was what I needed to do. I just want to say thank you for saving my life. It takes a lot of strength of character to do the right thing sometimes, and I'm so grateful that you did.
After A received treatment, his boss welcomed him back to work. He hopes that telling his story will encourage others to help people in crisis. If you or someone you know is in need of urgent mental health support, there are people who can help. Just call or text 988, and you can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at hiddenbrain.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at viking.com.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The story of federal funding for the arts over the last few months has had a clear theme: cuts. But then, get this, a House committee has approved a budget proposal to boost funding for the Kennedy Center, about six times what it usually gets each year from Congress. NPR's Jacqueline Diaz has been looking into this proposal and joins us now. Hey, Jacqueline.
Hey.
Okay, so what have you learned so far about this proposed funding?
Yeah, so this new proposal was approved by the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee last week. It's asking for more than $250 million for the Kennedy Center. And that's way more than the roughly $40 million it gets from Congress each year.
Yeah.
And almost all of this money would be specifically for operations, repair, and restoration of the building and not for concerts. This budget request comes straight from the White House, and it comes after President Trump made himself chairman of the center back in February. He also got rid of all Biden appointees on the Kennedy Center's board. Back in March, Trump visited the Kennedy Center and wasn't too impressed by what he saw.
It's in tremendous disrepair, as is a lot of the rest of our country, most of it because of bad management.
A White House spokesperson said this project is, quote, essential to advancing President Trump's vision of restoring greatness to our nation's capital.
Okay, you mentioned the money that's being proposed would be for operation and repairs, not for performances. Do you have any more details about what exactly this money could be used for then?
Yeah, so there are actually still a lot of questions around the specifics of the budget request.
Mm-hmm.
Kennedy Center President Richard Grenell said in a statement that the front and back of the house, quote, have been left in an embarrassing state. I spoke to Tushar Swain. He's the director of public policy for the Americans for the Arts. They're an arts advocacy group based in Washington, and he has some concerns because this budget request is happening when the White House has made major cuts to grants that fund the arts.
We support adequate and appropriate funding for the Kennedy Center because of how symbolic it is to our country. It should not be seen as a substitute for arts funding to these other critical agencies.
Hmm. Okay, well, what kinds of things are you hearing now from lawmakers about this idea to increase funding for the Kennedy Center?
Right. And so just to be clear, this is just a proposal right now. It's
right.
Part of a big bill that Republicans are hoping to pass by this summer. And President Trump calls it his big, beautiful bill. But at least one Democrat is raising some red flags about this money for the Kennedy Center. Representative Shelley Pingree of Maine is the top Democrat on the House committee that oversees funding for the National Endowment for the Arts. She called the proposal exorbitant. Republican leaders on the House Transportation Committee didn't want to comment.
And what about arts groups? Like, what do they make of this proposal?
Right. Tushar Swain of the Americans for the Arts said his group shares Congresswoman Pingree's concern. Their main question is, how is this funding different from what the center usually gets? There are rules and protections over how that government money is used by the Kennedy Center. For example, it can't pay for performances. But despite those rules, Swain has worries about how the money will actually be used.
And that, I think, is done in part to prevent government overreach and artistic expression. So, you know, do these funds also adhere to those principles as well?
That is NPR's Jacqueline Diaz. Thank you, Jacqueline.
Thank you.
The port city of Mumbai is home to Bollywood, stock markets and billionaire industrialists, and migrant workers who dream of making it big. Bringing them together is a soft but chewy bread called pao. It's a snack or meal for millions every day, but as air pollution increases, pao may soon be toast. NPR's Omkar Khandekar tells us more.
Every morning, while Mumbai sleeps, the Yazdani bakery staff wake up to knead the dough, cut it into little pieces and pop it into the oven to make 1,000 pieces of pao. When the bakery opens, they fly off the shelves. Pao is soft and fluffy, has a crusty top and a distinct smoky flavor. It comes in a stack of six, which is called a ladi. You eat it with the fried potato snack called vada or with the buttery vegetable mash called bhaji. Or use it to mop up curries, like food anthropologist Kurush Dalal does. Just don't ask him if it is healthy.
That's like saying, how healthy is it to breathe air? Is it healthy to breathe air? You have to breathe air.
About that air. In the last century, Mumbai has changed from a city of cotton mills to a metropolis of skyscrapers. The wood-fired bakeries have survived this monumental change. But their chimneys may now be the cause of their extinction.
It might be easier because the authorities here have begun a crackdown on tandoors and wood-fired ovens.
Early this year, the government's Pollution Control Board ordered all wood-fired bakeries to close by July. Even though wood-fired bakeries only contribute to 3% of the overall pollution in Mumbai. That's according to a recent study by an environmental group. Ravi Andhare is the chief of the Pollution Control Board that oversees Mumbai. He says every bit matters.
We have to see that we can reduce at all the sectors. It will be a cumulative result which will reduce the air pollution.
But former town council representative Makran Narvekar says what the Pollution Control Board is doing is hitting the little guy. He points out that the city's billion-dollar road construction project has been causing much more pollution in recent years.
The pollution that is emitted from these bakeries is nothing compared to the pollution that construction sites are contributing or the road repair sites are contributing.
The lead author of the study that analyzed wood-fired bakeries says one reason why bakeries are being targeted is that it's just easier to solve that little slice of the problem. This is environmental researcher and consultant Hema Ramani.
As far as the construction, the infrastructure, vehicles, it's got a lot of complexities. That's why we said let's look at, faster, quicker, smaller transitions that can happen, and then you move.
She says bakeries can switch to natural gas or electric ovens instead. But the president of Bombay Bakers Association, Nasir Ansari, says that will increase the cost of pav by more than a half. Ansari says it's the working class that eats pav most. For them, even a small price rise makes a huge difference. And bakers like Parson Zensei, pav needs the wood fire to give it that distinct smoky crunch.
In America, they smoke the chops and the smokiness is everything. It's like that, you get that smoky feel, yeah.
He says, likewise, losing wood-fired pav would take away something intangible from Mumbai's heritage. Imagine a Texas barbecue without smoke. Omkar Khandekar, NPR News, Mumbai.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance, clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere. At betterhelp.com/public. From Workday, Workday is an HR and finance platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to propelling organizations, workforces, and industries into the future. Workday, moving business forever forward. And we'll be right back.